Do you ever wonder what's happening behind the scenes of the multi-trillion dollar fashion industry? In the new podcast, Fashion People, Puck correspondent and 20-year fashion veteran Lauren Sherman and a rotating cast of industry insiders discuss what fashion people are really talking about behind the scenes of the star-studded business, from creative director switcheroos to M&A drama, DTC downfalls, and Met Gala mishaps. Fashion People, a presentation of Odyssey in partnership with Puck, is available now wherever you get your podcasts. Make Me Smart is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where? Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hello, everyone. I'm Kimberly Adams. Welcome back to Make Me Smart, where none of us is as smart as all of us.
I'm Kai Rosedahl. Tuesday, 9 April today. That means it's one topic, one show. We're talking EVs, the EV market. Lots of buzz about how it might be slowing, what's going on, what's the China factor, what are American companies doing. There's a lot going on in EVs, so we're going to talk about that.
Yeah, and to figure out how it's actually going and to make us smart about this whole thing is Robinson Meyer, who's the executive director of Heatmap, which is a media company focused on climate change. Sorry, founding executive editor, which is way more important, of Heatmap. And so welcome to the show, Robinson.
Thank you for having me. You got to get that founding in.
It's very crucial. It's crucial. You started it. So there are all these headlines about the slowdown in the EV market. How real is that?
Yeah, so what we saw in the first quarter is that EV sales growth is definitely down somewhat from the quarter before and seems to be slowing. So U.S. EV sales grew somewhere between 10 and 70%. We're waiting for all the numbers to come in the first quarter of this year. That's down from how they've been growing in the past when it was more exponential. But that is the second derivative, right? That is, the EV sales are no longer accelerating as much as they used to be, but they are still growing slightly quarter over quarter.
How come? Is that just because consumers are a little leery? What's going on out there?
Yeah, so what it seems to be, you know, the car market, the EV market right now is extremely uneven. And I think what we saw kind of a few years ago was that a lot of automakers got into the making EVs, they kind of threw a few models at the wall, and now we're seeing what sticks. And so, for instance, Ford tried to make a few EVs. They tried to make the E-Transit, which is like more of a commercial van. They tried to make the Mustang Mach-E, which is kind of a crossover. And they tried to make the Ford F-150 truck. And what they found is that lots and lots of people want to buy the Mach-E. You know, they can basically sell as many Mach-Es as they make. But they've had a lot of trouble moving the more expensive F-150 Lightning trucks. And I think that's kind of the story across the market as you look at automaker after automaker. The real other standout story is that Tesla is really, really slowing. Tesla had a lot of problems in Q1. They had a lot of problems just selling the vehicles they have. And so on the one hand, I think we have this EV market that's kind of undergoing growing pains. And on the other hand, we have a very specific Tesla story where Tesla sales are really, really, really growing down, slowing down.
I think we can get to Tesla separately, but I'm really curious about this idea of like throwing models at the wall and seeing which one works, because these car companies have been around for a very long time and typically are quite good at figuring out what kind of cars consumers will want and making said cars. Why is this so much harder when it comes to EVs?
I think there's two reasons. I mean, I think to some degree, the kind of cars that have sold the best over the past decade are also the kind of cars that we see moving the most when you make them into EVs. So I'd put the Ford Mach-E in that category. It's kind of this SUV crossover that is very popular with families. You know, Hyundai and Kia together have made a lot of vehicles, a lot of electric vehicles that have sold very well. And they've basically made three or four different variants on an SUV crossover form. I think what car companies anticipated as they got into this is that more heavy-duty vehicles might sell better, like the Ford F-150 Lightning. I think also the other thing that happened is that as car companies, you know, especially as Ford, GM, the big three, set forth on their EV journey, they wanted to signal to consumers that they were really serious about this. And so they took some of their most iconic brands and made EV versions of them, right? They made the F-150 Lightning. GM made an electric Hummer, which has sold in the hundreds of vehicles. These were like signaling cars, right? These were meant to signal that these automakers were extremely serious about the electric vehicle transition. Have they sold well? Not necessarily, but it was like the only electric Hummer I've ever seen in person was completely unused, sitting in the middle of like a big concrete plaza at the UN climate conference in Dubai.
God. There you go.
Like spackled with the logo for the police, specifically created to police this climate conference. And I was like, That is who buys the EV Hummer, you know, Emirati climate cops.
We should probably pause here for a manufacturing moment, right? When you take like an F-150, the most popular selling vehicle in this country by miles, or the Mach-E, which was like it got the Mustang branding, but whatever, right? It's not just a matter of taking the internal combustion engine out, slapping a battery on, and going, right? It's a huge investment for these car companies to do it, which helps explain why they're a little leery.
That's right. It just requires totally different hard tooling in the factories, and the whole supply chain is really different, right? Instead of pulling up lots and lots of small components that ultimately go into the internal combustion powertrain and whole internal combustion vehicle, right? Your main the main assets that you need to kind of organize across the production chain become minerals, become battery chemistries, become putting together these very chemically complex batteries and then putting them in the vehicles. You know, electric vehicles are actually not as complicated machines as an internal combustion vehicle is. I've heard people argue that this is one reason that China has been able to get as far as it has with EVs specifically, is that, you know, if we were still in an internal combustion world, China would have had a lot more trouble, you know, equaling or beating what's coming out of Western or legacy car makers. It's because EVs are so much simpler, and also because China is so good at making electronics, that they've been able to leapfrog what's happening in the US. And I think that story is kind of happening across the board too. But that means that ramping up EVs becomes this very delicate supply-demand question for automakers, because they don't want to get into a position where they've spent billions of dollars on a factory, retooling a factory, setting up a new factory, and then there's no demand for the cars that they're producing.
Well, on that demand point, the Biden administration has been rolling out all these tax credits and incentives to try to spur EV growth in the U.S., get more people to buy them. How is all that working so far?
It's working well. I think there are so many tax credits coming out of that have come out of the Biden administration, and so many tax credits that were set up by the Inflation Reduction Act, that it's really like a policy by policy story. I think, you know, the marquee policy we often hear about is this tax credit for individual Americans to buy electric vehicles that they're going to use as private passenger vehicles, you know, sedans, SUVs, crossovers, whatever. That is quite complicated. It's quite a complicated tax credit, and it's becoming more complicated over time. And that's because, you know, it's divided in two. You know, you get about half of the $7,500 if you make a battery in North America. You get another half of the $7,500 if you mine or process the critical minerals that go into the factory in North America or the United States, or like a free trade agreement country. It's a very complicated tax credit, intentionally so, because you know, Senator Joe Manchin, other moderate Democrats who negotiated that policy really wanted the goal of that policy to be to bring in EV manufacturing to the United States and to North America to create a, you know, EV manufacturing complex here. But there's a lot of other tax credits in the IRA and the Inflation Reduction Act that we never hear about. And one of them is, or we rarely hear about, you know, one of them is this commercial vehicle tax credit. And that says that if you are a company and you are purchasing an EV for any commercial purpose, then you get $7,500 back, you know, off the cost of that EV. Now, a lot of one of the specified purposes in the law is leasing out a vehicle. So if you're, say, a bank or a dealership's, you know, lending authority, and you're buying a vehicle and then leasing it out to an American who's going to drive it, you can just pass along that full $7,500 discount. And we see a lot of manufacturers doing that now. And so some of the best EV deals you see out there are actually for leasing vehicles. You know, Hyundai is now advertising its Ioniq vehicles for about $3,000 down and then $220, $230 a month, which is a really good deal compared to what else is out there on the market. There's a whole third set of tax credits, all for manufacturing EVs and manufacturing batteries. And the funny thing is, we like never hear about those policies, but they are actually the most important from a manufacturer perspective, as Ford, as GM, as Hyundai set up their EV plants in the United States.
The gap in manufacturing, both the cars themselves and the batteries and the rest of the infrastructure, between what we produce in this country and what, say, the Chinese produce or what the Europeans produce, is huge. And I guess my question is, do you think all of this is enough to close the gap?
I think it's too early to say. I mean, I think a lot of China got where it is on EVs by doing a lot of the policies that the U.S. is doing now. I mean, if you look at the IRA, there's a ton of stuff that we've basically borrowed from the Chinese policy playbook. And I should say, China borrowed those policies from our policy playbook back in the 70s and 60s and 50s. Mm-hmm. You know, there's kind of a set of policies you can do. You can pull demand, you can push supply, you can do a lot of different things across the supply chain to build up a new industry. There's only so many policies, and China has gotten good at doing them in the 20-teens, but there's no reason the U.S. couldn't get good at doing them again. We used to do them, especially in the defense sector, all the time. Do I think this is enough? I think it's really hard to say, and I think the key question I have about the U.S., you know, America's ability to compete with China and the American economy's ability to compete with China on EVs is around demand. So the Chinese automakers, they've gotten a lot of headlines in the past month because they're making these incredible vehicles. They're making, you know, BYD just unveiled a $9,500 electric hatchback that's basically comparable to a Chevy Bolt, which, like, right, goes for about double that price when we're making it. And we're not even making it right now. That one reason that BYD can sell a $9,500 EV is because not only are there so many subsidies in China, because China has, you know, aggressively paid and past policy to set up an extremely advanced vehicle ecosystem, you know, manufacturing ecosystem domestically in China, but also just because the Chinese market is huge and a lot of people are buying their first car. And a lot of Chinese automakers have gotten really good at selling to those, you know, low margin, high volume vehicles to the very bottom of the Chinese market. And if you've never had a car before, a $9,500 EV sounds pretty great. And guess what? BYD has gotten really good at making inexpensive cars because it's catered to the bottom of the Chinese market for so long. In the US, you know, most of us have cars. And there's not an upwardly mobile class here that is buying, you know, the first car that anyone in their family has had in a generation. And that means that cars have to be of higher quality. People expect more out of them. And that means there's not this kind of lower segment that brands can experiment in and brands can sell a very cheap vehicle in that then brings down costs across their manufacturing operation. I think the key question I have about all of these IRA policies is that, you know, unless we build more chargers across the country and make it easier for people to have an EV, you know, the infrastructure we have right now already exists really favors gas cars. And without boosting the EV infrastructure, there's just not going to be the demand that automakers will need in order to produce cars here.
since we were talking about BYD, BYD briefly dethroned Tesla as the world-leading EV seller. And it's funny because I thought this conversation was going to focus a lot more about Tesla, but this other stuff is way more interesting. So, I mean, just like passing reference to it, how important is Tesla in the future of EVs?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think what we can say is that Tesla is an extremely important American company in the future of EVs. And up until last quarter, we would have said that, you know, Tesla was one of the, or up until the past few quarters, we would have said Tesla is the dominant global EV maker.
Right.
You know, that you could look past all these new Chinese entrants, Tesla's still making more EVs and selling more EVs than anyone else. That stopped being true in the fourth quarter of last year. It kind of has briefly become true again in the first quarter of this year. We'll see what happens in the second quarter. The key thing, though, is that Tesla has real corporate problems in a way that is starting to become apparent. And I actually
diplomatic.
Before you talk about Elon Musk, like, let's put Elon Musk to the side. Yeah. Even with Elon, you'd still say, boy, Tesla's a company in trouble, because they have the Model S, the Model 3, the Model X, and the Model Y, right? Well, three out of the four of those vehicles are really no longer segment leaders, and all of them are getting pretty old. Yeah. So you have, you know, the Tesla, the Model Y was unveiled in 2019. Now, it took a little while for them to start selling it, but it actually, the Model Y was only unveiled 6 months before the Cybertruck was unveiled. And Reuters reported last week that Tesla has canceled the production of the next vehicle in its lineup, the vehicle that people were really excited about, which is this $25,000 car that they say, you know, we can get even, we can have economies of scale work even better for us. Never mind the Model 3 or the Model Y, which kind of both sell in the high 30s. We can make a $25,000 car. And that was going to be like not only Tesla, but kind of, you know, the American automaking sector's answer to BYD and these Chinese electric vehicles. But Reuters reported last week, as I just said, that they have canceled it. Tesla, I should say, disputes that report, but Reuters had a lot of substantiation, and Tesla really hasn't substantiated much. And a lot of the, you know, disputation has come from Elon's Twitter account without really any more detail. Tesla says it's going to unveil this robotaxi, which has previously been described as a $25,000 car, but without a steering wheel, that will rely entirely on Tesla's full self-driving software in August. But there's a lot of bugs and problems around Tesla's full self-driving software. In fact, Tesla doesn't even refer to it as being full self-driving software anymore. If you look, it says like full self-driving. No, they're not allowed to. They have to say it's they say it's supervised. So the actual name of this software now is full self-driving, open paren, supervised, close paren, which is like kind of an oxymoron, right? So I think the big thing for Tesla is that Tesla's lineup is getting really old. And if this $25,000 car has been canceled, then they have been working, what have they been working on for the past 3 to 4 years? It's crazy to think about a car company that just doesn't seem to have a product pipeline at all, which is where Tesla seems to be. I mean, maybe they have this robotaxi, but there seems like there's big problems with it. And so but Tesla has historically made up more than half of the US EV market. And while its share is dwindling by the quarter, it is still an extremely important part of the US EV, you know, supply picture and the EVs that are available to consumers. And as their vehicle quality continues to deteriorate against what else is available in the market, I think we're going to continue to see them, you know, their sales share and just their vehicle deliveries deteriorate as well.
Robinson Meyer, founding executive editor of Heatmap. That was a lot of good info on that. Thank you.
Thanks, Robinson. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
I guess the next couple of quarters are really going to tell the story of the future of the EV market. I didn't realize we were quite kind of in this pivot moment almost, it seems.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And the idea that Tesla ain't the world leader anymore, you know, it's the rise of the rest, right? The Chinese, the Europeans, mm-hmm. They're all doing this. And you know, Elon Musk tried to change the world all by himself. And then everybody caught on and said, well, we can make money doing this. And here they are, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I would be curious to hear from the folks. Well, I know you have an EV, Kai, but especially the people who've been sort of like on the fence about it, what the last year or so with the mix of the tax credits and everything going on with Tesla, how your thinking has changed about it, if at all. And the folks who've had EVs for a while now, how are you feeling about it? Anyhow, tell us about it, 508-827-6278, also known as 508-EV-SMART. We will be right back.
Strong communication skills are critical for success in business and in life. Hi, I'm Matt Abrahams, and I host Stanford Graduate School of Business's Think Fast, Talk Smart, the podcast. Each week, I sit down with experts to discuss the best tips to help you with your communication skills, from conflict management to mastering small talk to tackling communication anxiety. Join us and start to develop and hone your communication skills. Listen every Tuesday wherever you get your podcasts or on YouTube.
All right. News. Kimberly Adams, go.
Yes. Speaking of technology and automation, I saw this really interesting story in the Wall Street Journal about the robots slicing your barbecue ribs and how...
Sorry. Okay.
It says, meet the robots slicing your barbecue ribs.
I know.
Yes. And it's got images and videos of exactly that, very high-tech robots sort of slicing the ribs. And, you know, apologies to all the vegans and animal rights folks on here, but lots of people eat meat, and the jobs in the meatpacking industry are incredibly dangerous for the people who do that work. And it's often not the best wages. It's often done by very people in some of the most vulnerable communities, and they can get some really terrible injuries. And for that reason, among others, they have had really bad labor shortages in the meat industry. COVID was a big part of that. And so I'm just going to read here from the journal. Meat packers are increasingly looking to robots for help. Smithfield, the largest U.S. pork processor, began rolling out automated rib pullers at its pork plant several years ago, which company officials said helps leave less wasted meat on the bone and relieves workers from some of the industry's most physically demanding jobs, allowing workers to be reassigned from pulling loins or ribs to food quality inspection jobs. Mm. And frankly, that is what I would rather humans be doing. I would much rather have the humans being the ones checking to make sure that the food is safe and doesn't have like weird stuff in it than, you know, wielding the knives and doing the super dangerous work of the meatpacking industry. And so I am here for the robots.
I did a story many, many years ago out of Sioux Falls, South Dakota. There is a pork processing plant there bought by the Chinese about 5 years ago. Anyway, I interviewed a young 25-ish-year-old Bhutanese refugee immigrant who had a job there doing whatever it was, but it was such repetitive motion over so many long hours. He had a callus on his thumb that was, I kid you not, the size of a quarter. It was wild. And he was telling stories about being in this pork processing plant. So yeah, I'm here for the robots. Totally. Totally, totally, totally. Wild. Absolutely.
And it's so interesting because these types of jobs, the narrative around robots taking over these jobs is so different than the narrative of robots taking over, say, the assembly line at a car plant, right? Uh-huh. And those are also repetitive motion jobs, but they were typically paid better and done by different types of people. And I'm curious, like, how this is going to progress moving forward, you know?
So to our previous conversation about EVs and more broadly, new energy and cleaner energy in this economy, story in the New York Times that I saw this morning, knowing we were going to have this conversation, which becomes my news item. Headline in the Times, the U.S. urgently needs a bigger grid, that is to say electric grid. Here is a fast solution. So there are paper's out today, research report's out today, talking about this thing called advanced reconductoring. And what it means is replacing all those high-tension power lines, the lines literally themselves, which are currently mostly steel cores surrounded by aluminum, with new materials, carbon fiber among them, which gets you a huge boost in transmission capacity. And as we know, one of the big problems with clean energy, like you have to get all that wind power from the middle of, you know, I don't know, Texas, where the wind blows a lot, to places like, I don't know, California, Chicago, Dallas, where they need a lot of power. And this can really help do it. Here's the catch. It's being used in many other parts of the country. Here's the catch, though. In the United States, we are not doing it because, and this is a quote, many U.S. utilities have been slow to embrace it, advanced reconductoring, because of their unfamiliarity with the technology, okay, fine, as well as regulatory and bureaucratic hurdles, the researchers found. So we have to get out of our own way.
Yeah.
Kind of wild.
When I went to do some reporting on sort of the shortage of electricians as we try to electrify America, the people who own these sort of electrician companies, they're like, yes, we need more electricians. We're happy to invest in training these kids so that we can hire them, but that's not going to help us when the grid can't handle it. And everybody wants, you know, all of these new all-electric things and to charge their cars, but if there's not enough grid support, none of us can do anything. So this is a problem that does need solving.
For sure.
All right. So that is it for the news. Let's do the mailbag.
Hi, Kai and Kimberly.
This is Godfrey from San Francisco.
Jesse from Charleston, South Carolina.
And I have a follow-up question.
It has me thinking and feeling a lot of things.
During our last deep dive, we talked with Sarah McCammon about the exvangelical movement, which is that term for folks who've left the evangelical Christian church. Particularly, she was talking about white evangelical Christians. And we asked if any of you all consider yourself a part of the exvangelical group, and we got this.
This is Michael from Denver, Colorado. I would consider myself an exvangelical. Basically realized there were issues with kind of the intellectual side of the evangelical community, political side of the evangelical community. With that said, now that I'm 43 and I have three little kids, I am finding myself drawn back into the evangelical community a little bit, maybe not as much as I was before, just because of the good stuff that Kimberly mentioned, the community, the kind of the heartfeltness of wanting to good, all that kind of stuff.
Interesting.
I really do think that the sense of community that people get from religious spaces is really challenging to replicate in other formats. Because, I mean, I think about when I went to church as a kid, it was Sunday school where the kids were hanging out. It was the broader church where kids and adults were hanging out. You had social activities like your choir and your plays and your liturgical dance or whatever, and outreach in the community. I would go out with my dad on Sunday afternoons to, because he was a deacon, and we would do what's called, you know, ministering to the sick and shut-in, where we would literally go and visit older people or sick people who couldn't come to church and just kind of talk to them, give communion and things like that. And without that framework of the church, a lot of those things fall by the wayside. And I think people really long for that.
Yeah. And as we know, you know, community is a not small part of what is lacking in this society today. And research shows that. So
yeah,
wherever you can
find
it, wherever you can find it. All right. One more. A little while ago, a couple of weeks maybe, we talked about a study finding dogs can associate some words with objects. We got this from Theodore in Colorado.
My dog, Lucy, and I do a thing where she has to wait for her dinner or breakfast. And the word free lets her know she can be released. Part of the game is that I'll say a whole bunch of related similar words like peas, tea, flea. And she still waits even when those wrong words are given. So she definitely understands.
That is a smart dog, man. Are you kidding me?
Did you go ahead and test that out with Willow?
I did. And she's goofy. And she'll, like, you stand near the closet and she goes to take the food. So words don't help that dog. Yeah.
What about Bonsai?
Well, Bonds is old and cranky, so I don't know if she's a valid test subject, actually. Okay. Also, she's got, like, digestion issues, so, you know, food is not her friend right now. More than you need to know about my dog, perhaps. But anyway.
Well, we do have a very cute photo that Theodore sent us of his very smart dog, Lucy, who is a very good girl. Just putting it
great
out
picture.
There. And I imagine we'll put it on the show notes.
Okay. All right. On the way out, this week's answer, as we always do to the Make Me Smart question, what is something you thought you knew but later found out you were wrong about? This one comes from Kevin Lewis, professor of Earth and Planetary Sciences at Johns Hopkins, because yesterday, eclipse. Here we go.
I used to think a lot more that we could discount the possibility of low probability events. One of the weird things about our planet is that we have a large moon that appears the same size as the sun in the sky. Now, the sun is 400 times larger than the moon, but the distance to the moon is just right to appear the same size, and it's totally a random coincidence. In graduate school, I was working on the possibility of another problem related to the moon, and had concluded that it didn't happen because the likelihood came out to only being a 10% chance. My professor just replied, well, 10% events happen 10% of the time. Of course, in some sense, that's obvious. But the unlikely match of the sizes of the sun and the moon in our sky, which we saw spectacularly during the eclipse, shows that sometimes low probability events do occur.
Piece in the New York Times today pointing out that in some very long period of time, billions of years, the moon will have moved far enough away from the Earth that we're not going to be able to have total solar eclipses anymore.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
I did not think about this before reading this earlier from, you know, when I was looking, prepping for the show, that how random it is that the sun and moon appear the same size.
Yep.
But as someone who consumes large volumes of science fiction and fantasy, often in the imagery associated with it, you do have like giant moons or teeny tiny moons, and those would not give eclipses in the same way. That's so interesting to think about.
Totally.
Yeah. All right. That is it for us today. We want to hear your answer to the Make Me Smart question. What is something you thought you knew that you later found out you were wrong about? Our number is 508-827-6278, also known as 508-UB-SMART.
Make Me Smart is produced by Courtney Bergseeker. Ellen Rolfes writes our newsletter. Today's program was engineered by Jessen Dueler. Ming-Hsin Tseguan is going to mix it down later. Talia Menchaca is our intern.
Ben Tolliday and Daniel Ramirez composed our theme music. Our senior producer is Marissa Cabrera. Bridget Bodner is the director of podcasts. Francesca Levy is the executive director of digital. And Marketplace's vice president and general manager is Neil Scarborough.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.